Welcome to Farcast. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. We have a great Farcast for you this evening as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world, trying to bring more sense, common sense anyway, to investors as you approach your portfolios and the way we're thinking about trade wars and achieving your long-term goals. We go to some of the best experts we can find on Wall Street and Washington, and also covering the world, bringing some new investment ideas and perspectives. Tonight, I'm going to cover a little bit of the current volatility. Yesterday was one of the biggest down days we've seen in quite a while on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, down 617 points, rallied back 207 points today, still 410 points in the hole. I'm going to tell you what I think. I was on CNBC earlier today. I had a very frustrating discussion with some folks that didn't make a lot of sense to me, and I'll tell you why. And then I'm going to talk about what we can expect, I believe, from markets and the economy as we go forward. On Washington, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress will be joining us. And there is so much to talk about, a refocus on the Federal Reserve, what has worked and what hasn't worked with China and this trade negotiation policy. Dan is an expert not only on a lot of what's going on politically in Washington, but also in China, a student of Chinese. He speaks Mandarin and he studied in China. And then one of the brightest economists I've ever known. I'm so thrilled he's going to be with us tonight in segment three as we cover the world. Martin Barnes from the Bank Credit Analyst, one of the brightest guys I've ever gotten to read and gotten to know over the years, will be joining us with his views on the economy, what's working, what isn't working, and what the president meant today when he said that the best thing that could happen would be for the Fed to cut rates. Martin Barnes doesn't think so. We're going to find out why in segment three. But first, remember that on the Farcast, we believe that money is hard to make. We believe that old-fashioned research, hard work, discipline, and diligence are the keys to successful investing. And finally, remember that we believe that emotion is the foe of the long-term investor. And if you are feeling fearful, as well you may be after yesterday, or if you are feeling gleeful, and maybe greedy would be a bit better word, and just have to get you some of that stock market, stop, take a walk around the block, find yourself a sane friend or wise counselor, and talk to the dog if you have to. Just don't do anything with your money when you're feeling that way. Joining me in segment one, our producer, Harry Jennings, of course, with us every week. And Harry, it was a very interesting week.
Interesting to say the least. One of the things that I just found really remarkable is that the last five trading days, we've moved the markets more than 1% during the day. And that's more, only 4 days did that happen during the entire calendar year in 2017.
At the beginning of this year, Harry, we said that the best prediction that I could offer was that volatility would be our constant companion in 2019. Hey, I get to claim victory over something. I mean, it's not much, but you know, it's. I mean, I thought it was about as insightful as saying I think it's going to be warm this summer, but we'll see. So far, it's proving right. You know, we weren't at all volatile in 2017. Volatility indeed picked up in 2018, and it is continuing in 2019. One of the things that I'm watching, ladies and gentlemen, is that as markets were really focused on whatever the Federal Reserve said it was going to do with monetary policy. You know, we saw that big dip coming into December last year where markets did go down a full 20% at the lows in late December. And then when the Federal Reserve said, sorry, we didn't really mean it, we're going to go to the sidelines, no hard feelings, markets have rallied and rallied nicely. And we've shifted from that dependence on every utterance from the Fed now to a new dependence on any tweet from the president and maybe a couple of words interspersed, sprinkled in there from Larry Kudlow and Bob Lighthizer and Secretary Mnuchin on what's going on with China. So with all of that going on, I was invited to be on CNBC today. And I was on with another strategist, a chief investment officer of a very large bank, and his headline was he was reducing his risk posture. He was de-risking his portfolio by 4.4%, moving away from the allocation to equities. And I thought that that really, I think I was nice on TV. Wasn't I nice on TV today, Harry?
I thought you were nice about it.
I was trying to find a nice way to say that's the dumbest damn thing I think I've ever heard. And it makes absolutely no sense to me unless your entire intention was to find a way to get yourself on TV. Because strategically, you don't change, Harry, you don't change your investments for billions and billions of dollars based on what the market did yesterday. I mean, that's just moronic. You've got a clear discipline, and you follow it as an investor. And so Tyler Matheson said, well, Michael, when you see a daylight, and I tried to say that nicely. I hope I did. But Tyler Matheson then looked at me and said, well, Michael, shouldn't you do something? Are you saying you don't do anything when the market goes down like this and you just don't react, you just ride it out? I said, no, that's not what I'm saying at all. You don't do anything on these short-term, big move sorts of days. You've already done it. If you're a disciplined portfolio manager, you've already made your moves. You've already positioned your portfolio. And in fact, that's your job. It's not your job to react to the market when it goes down, when these stupid emotional days come by. And by the way, from the highs, the new all-time highs the markets made, stocks made in April, yesterday, at the low, we were down 4.5%. Now, I could have said to this big chief strategist, why would you reduce your risk exposure by 4.4% when the market just reduced it for you yesterday by 4.5%, you moron? But I didn't do that because I'm polite. But that's what happened. So what I told Tyler was, I said, look, after a market rallies, as it had through April, 25% in 3 months or 3.5 months from the lows in December through the highs in mid-April, a disciplined portfolio manager is, of course, looking to opportunistically de-risk a portfolio, looking for areas where that where those stocks and those holdings may have violated price discipline, the purchase discipline. I mean, we have a number of disciplines surrounding our holdings, and we have a strong four-point sell discipline, and we follow it pretty rigorously. So you don't make a change based on what's going on day to day, but when you see things appreciate 25%, portfolio managers should have perhaps harvested some of those gains and redeployed those gains, taken that cash and put it into stuff that hadn't done well. And you have to look for stuff that's not sexy. It's not fun to be an investor. You don't chase the latest, hottest idea, even though, you know, the church, worshiping at the church of what's working now is always a little more fun. It's not fun in December to say, gee, I think I want to buy Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble is one of the most deadly, boring stocks you can possibly own. I mean, there is nothing sexy about toothpaste and mouthwash. But people keep buying the stuff in all kind of economic environments. And when everything else is going to hell and the semiconductor chip stocks are falling through the floor, guess what? People are still buying their mouthwash and toothpaste. Procter & Gamble is up 20% so far in 2019. And if you wanted to find a stock that was trading in the green yesterday on your screen, you only had to look as far as Procter & Gamble.
I think that was the only one of the 30 on the Dow. I think Procter & Gamble. I think so. And that was something that you know struck me in watching you on CNBC. The idea of de-risking a portfolio is to de-risk it before something risky happens. You know, if you don't hit the brakes after you've run into the wall. So that was something that struck me as just, did I understand what he said correctly?
Well, I think that it's always in vogue to let your clients see that you're reacting and doing things in their portfolio. Really good portfolio management, in my opinion, and in my over 30 years of experience is a very boring thing to watch. It is like watching the wallpaper dry on the wall. It is not fun, but you have to do it in a very disciplined way. And it is a very boring process, and done properly should yield a rather exciting result over time. And that's our goal anyway at Farm Miller in Washington. That's my goal in my own portfolio. I love to buy a stock that I could just buy and never have to sell, and perhaps explain to my grandchildren one day that there was a brand new stock called Facebook. And this was when we just had the internet, children, if you can imagine your grandfather being so horribly old. And yes, I spent this many dollars on it. Now I have this many millions of dollars in it. And you should wait till I die so you get a stepped-up cost basis. But it was a good idea then. That's what you do. You buy things that have good fundamentals and good earnings and strong balance sheets. Ladies and gentlemen, Facebook has some pretty strong fundamentals. It is not way out there in the trees. It is not a it is not a Tesla where you can't find a balance sheet and all they have is more and more debt, and they're not even executing on sales. So there are some risky things out there. I'm getting ready. I'm really running out of my time here for segment one. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, this China trade agreement is not done. It's not going to be done anytime soon. You've got cultural differences between China and the U.S. You have a president who likes to make deals in public. That's very, very messy, and it's something to which investors and many Americans aren't used. But that's okay. I'm not criticizing what the president's doing or not doing. In fact, I'm very pleased that the president is addressing this China imbalance. It has been criminal for years. We have to do something about it. Is this the right way to go about it? I don't know. Nobody else has tried anything for it. Let's let this guy have a shot at it. God, it's ugly to watch him do it in public. It's just awful to watch this president do this in public. But maybe it's going to work. So God bless him and God bless the United States. Maybe it will work. Ladies and gentlemen, do not think that this is going to end quickly. Don't, and please, I think it's only reasonable to expect that there will be a good deal more messiness in the weeks and months ahead. A lot more messiness. So what do? You understand we're going to have some volatility, number one. Number two, I think you have to see that this president, prior to a 2020 election, needs some kind of a deal with China that's going to goose these markets. Whether it's going to be a real deal that actually accomplishes something for the United States, or whether it's a headline deal that sort of looks like a deal but makes the markets feel better. Either way, stocks go up, okay? Either way, stocks go up. There's a cost of doing business here that's going to slow the economy. These tariffs are going to slow the economy. Ronald Reagan said you don't get more of something by taxing it. Grover Norquist, big Republican, hates taxes, says tariffs are taxes. So we recognize that it's a tax. We recognize that it's going to be a cost of doing business. It just may work, and it's something that I think we have to do and address with China. So know that we have this volatility. Know that a deal's in the offing somewhere. Be opportunistic and disciplined, and don't be emotional. I have my sights set on a couple of different stocks I really want to purchase. I really want to buy them. 4.5% move is not enough to get me interested. People pay us to do this, so I'm not going to give you the details on it, but that's what I am doing. The Chinese just pulled a Donald Trump on Donald Trump, is what it looks like to me. Thought they had a deal done. Thought they were sending over the terms of the deal. They sent him a red line deal with everything corrected and said, well, we're going to change the deal. That's classic Trump. They pulled it on Trump. It's not working with Trump, but let's see how this goes back and forth. It's not over. Going to be messy. There are going to be some opportunities. It does get resolved, and the Fed is on the sidelines. Most important thing you really do need to know is that the Fed is on the sidelines. There's lots of liquidity in the market, and interest rates are low. We will survive this. Coming up, Dan Mahaffey, we're going to talk about Washington and politics in segment two. Please stay with me. I'm so grateful you've tuned in again this week. I'll be right back. It's Michael Farr on the Farcast.
You're listening to Farcast.
Do you have an upcoming function and need a dynamic speaker to engage your audience? You've enjoyed listening to the Farcast, so why not invite Michael Farr to speak at your next event? In addition to hosting the Farcast and serving as president of the advisory firm Farr, Miller, and Washington, Michael is the longest-serving paid contributor to CNBC. He is recognized by audiences, and his presentations on the economic outlook are always well-received. Michael has recently appeared at such venues as the Economic Club of Memphis, the University of Delaware, Matheson Financial Conference, and the YPO-WPO Economic Summit. Add your event to the growing list of organizations who have been informed and captivated by Michael's insights. For more information, or to book Michael for an upcoming event, please email me, Harry Jennings, at hjennings@farmiller.com or call me at 202-530-5608.
You're listening to Farcast. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. I hope that the discussion of what's going on in Washington and markets and what I think is just absolutely silly on Wall Street is somewhat helpful to you. I know that our segment two, as we talk about Washington with our senior political analyst, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, will be very helpful. Dan's just kind of one of those walking Washington encyclopedias. He's a absolute genius with a real expertise in China, speaks Mandarin and studied there. Welcome back to the Farcast, Dan.
Hey, Michael, good to be talking to you.
We're very glad you're back. A very interesting week here. The China trade talks have broken down. The president has imposed tariffs. We really haven't heard back from the Chinese about exactly what they're going to do, except they're going to have tariffs. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I think what we had was a lot of optimistic statements coming from the White House, which certainly wanted to buoy markets. But as we've always talked about, it was going to come down to the enforcement of any agreement and how the Chinese were actually going to, hold to their end of the bargain rather than continue to run out the clock or slow down the implementation of major reforms. And I think now we have a situation where the president is trying to push the Chinese, but ultimately we have to answer some longer term questions about the path both countries are on.
What does that mean, Dan? Some longer-term questions about the path both countries are on. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that we've seen here the president's statements are very good. The best way it was told to me, he was very good at the confrontation, but now we need to worry about the competition. The Chinese are continuing to focus on advanced technologies, continuing to try and build their dominance in that domain. And we also have a situation where there's a fundamental interest of President Xi to continue his hold on both the political and economic levers in China. And any reforms that weaken those are certainly not an auspicious start to the beginning of the Xi era of Chinese politics. So China continues to want to have this growth in these areas where they require to take our intellectual property, to take the technology transfer. And that was a major sticking point that Lighthizer and Mnuchin and the other negotiators were going to be pushing on from the U.S. side. I think this is where the philosophical and political differences that we kind of papered over when we were talking about soybeans or purchases of natural gas or things like that come to the front of the situation here.
You know, it struck me, and I mentioned this in segment one, that the Chinese basically tried to pull a Trump on Trump. Here we have this negotiation, an agreement in principle. They send a copy of it that they were supposed to discuss over the weekend, and the thing is redlined to death, basically nulling most all of the substantive parts of the agreements. And just when you think you've got a deal, the Chinese basically said, yeah, well, except for all the important parts, we're good with it. I mean, that's mm-hmm. like classic Donald Trump, isn't it?
Well, to a certain extent, yeah, it's the art of the deal translated into Mandarin. I think the other part of it is that...
that's the headline, Harry. Headline, Harry, art of the deal translated into Mandarin.
I think we've got it, yep.
No, the Chinese have this long history. They remember their memory goes back to the Opium War, the unequal treaties as they described them that were forced on them by the British, the French, and other Westerners. And they saw that as a period of national humiliation that they will never repeat. And even though there are reformers in China who want to see some of these measures taken themselves, the hardliners in the Xi Jinping era have the upper hand, and no one wants to be seen as kowtowing to pressure from the West. That's the historical vision. But then looking forward to, they think that with when you don't have to answer to an electorate or your state-owned industries don't worry about quarterly earnings reports, that they ultimately have the upper hand in dealing with both the United States as well as any other Western allies of ours.
All right, Dan. So this was some insight we had a couple of weeks ago on the Farcast from Chris Campbell as he was explaining how they worked and set up Yum Brands China as a separate company from Yum Brands. Yum Brands in China operates the same three restaurant chains, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and Kentucky Fried Chicken, or KFC, I guess we call it these days. They have 9,000 restaurants in China. But, you know, Chris pointed out that the Chinese government, I can't remember whether he said, Chinese government owns 10 to 15% of Yum Brands China. It trades on the New York Stock Exchange. But the negotiation of that, the terms for that 10 to 15%, they actually hired representation in the U.S. to negotiate that for them. They paid a pretty good price for it, but they wanted to have a third-party intermediary whom they could blame if things didn't work out well. They were willing to pay that price rather than perhaps be embarrassed by a not-so-good deal. So, I mean, what you're telling us is a very consistent experience in doing business with the Chinese, isn't it?
Yes, and it's certainly, you know, culturally the principle of face and not backing down or not being seen as a failure in any negotiation is extremely important. But longer term, we have to think, and this is where I don't see any of the Democratic candidates talking about it either, very few people in Congress. What are we doing? We can't contain China. This is not the Soviet Union. This is not a backward communist society. This is a growing and vibrant country, even though it has a political system and human rights record that is abhorrent. But you're not going to be able to contain them. So how do we outcompete them? We confrontation is one thing, competition is the other. How are we investing in our education system, our infrastructure, science, technology, those things that will give us the upper hand that we've probably taken for granted for far too long?
You're suggesting we've been a bit complacent, that we've rested on our laurels, and we have a serious competitor out there, and we better get to our knitting and fast. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Precisely. And the Chinese have understood to slow roll this. They saw how we responded to Sputnik and Soviet advances like that, and we moved on the space race. We moved in the Eisenhower administration to really push ahead. They understand the American system is, you know, you can get us with the high blood pressure because we only pay attention to the heart attacks.
The high blood pressure and heart attacks, notwithstanding, the U.S., ladies and gentlemen, ranks somewhere between 30 and 35th in the world for reading, writing, reading, math, and science. We rank somewhere between 30th and 35th in the world, behind Ireland, behind Canada, and behind Poland, for my World War II friends out there. All of those countries, young people scoring much better than our U.S. Children. Education is not helping us, and the Chinese are rocking in terms of education. So we do need to get on this. Go ahead, Dan.
And what I find amazing about those statistics is that actually if you break it out and you take the schools that are in places like the Main Line of Philly, North Shore of Chicago, Westchester County, all those areas, those schools actually still compete with the Japans, the Chinas, and the Singapores. But then you take the rest of the country, and that's what drags you down because those the rest of the country is actually closer to the Colombia and Balkan countries. So that's another division we have to figure out.
Dan, we've got 2 minutes, and I've got to get moving to cover a couple of other things here. But I've suggested that this is not going to be solved quickly, that there will be more mess to disturb markets to follow. Stay tuned, not just for weeks, but probably for months. You agree with that? Yes, quickly, no?
I agree with that. In markets, you got to be like at the end of Indiana Jones and just look away.
Just look away. Avert your eyes. Don't turn to a pillar of salt. Salt is not a lot of fun. So, Dan, I want to cover just quickly two more things. Tell me what's – I want to – how many people now are running for president, presidential candidacy in the Democratic Party? I mean
– I think 22 officially now. I've got my – I got to take my shoes off to count how many now. But I think we're even past that. So we've got the governor of Montana coming in.
Steve Bullock is going to deliver.
Yeah.
Steve Bullock is the governor of Montana. He plans to deliver all 1.06 million votes in the great state of Montana. You know, as you study an electoral college map, ladies and gentlemen, and yes, I'm being snarky, Montana is absolutely necessary to winning the election in no one's poll, on no one's map, but good for Mr. Bullock. He seems like a very reasonable guy. So we, of course, wish him and all the candidates the best. Move quickly for me, Dan, to the Middle East and tell me what's going on as we're sending ships to the Gulf and increasing the heat of our rhetoric with Iran.
Mm-hmm. I think we should be concerned about a miscalculation here. You've got the Iranian proxies and militias in the region. We've seen sabotage of some kind of four oil tankers, possibly more, in the Strait of Hormuz. We also had the Houthis, which are a Iranian proxy in Yemen, launched drone strikes on a major pipeline in Saudi Arabia. This is where you have Iran and its network of militias and terrorist groups potentially coming into conflict with the U.S. And I think while President Trump wants to avoid conflict, one, you can't assume that there won't be some kind of conflict with the Saudis or the Emiratis that we end up getting involved in, as well as a certain provocation that allows a hardliner like National Security Advisor Bolton to push for more robust options against the Iranians.
Ladies and gentlemen, as we think about these things going on in Washington and around the world the one thing you need to remember, I encourage you to remember, is that we learned on Monday that the market doesn't like to be surprised. We were surprised by tariffs towards the end of the week, some of the tweets, some of the rhetoric responses from China. Markets don't like to be surprised. There is a surprise brewing in the Persian Gulf right now, ladies and gentlemen. Pay attention. Try not to be too surprised. When you see that sort of a conflict come along, you're going to see a whole chain reaction. The price of oil will go up substantially, not to mention what will happen as we think about trade with various partners, what that will do with our negotiations with China. All gets very, very complicated. From the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, the great Dan Mahaffey on the Farcast. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be right back with my friend Martin Barnes from the Bank Credit Analyst, one of the smartest economists I've ever talked to in my life, has a great broad perspective, and he's going to tell us why he doesn't think the Fed should probably step up to the president's encouragement and lower rates in here when we come back on the Farcast.
You're listening to Farcast.
Thank you for listening to The Farcast. We'd like to introduce a new daily show for you, The Farcast's 3-Minute Morning Brief. Every morning before the sun rises, we bring you markets, commodities, and futures. Just the facts to start your day. The Farcast's 3-Minute Morning Brief. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, or your favorite platform. And now, back to Michael and The Farcast.
Now more with Michael Farr and The Farcast.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. We really do appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed our first segment on Wall Street as we discussed the roller coaster of the Dow Jones and S&P and what's been happening given the China trade wars. Dan Mahaffey, I think, gave us some pretty good insights into how the Chinese negotiate his time, both in his studies at Georgetown University, his time on Capitol Hill, which he does every day, and then his studies in China in his postgraduate work, I think were very, very insightful. But now a real treat, ladies and gentlemen. My friend Martin Barnes, the chief economist from the Bank Credit Analyst Bank BCA Research, he is the chief economist. I've known Martin for years and years. One of the smartest guys I ever get to talk to, and has this wonderful global, broad global view that helps we folks over here in the United States keep a bit of perspective in terms of our relevance and our position with the rest of the world. He has been with BCA Research since 1987. He is the author of a book, The Ultimate Investor. Legendary investor Dean LeBaron actually featured Mr. Barnes as one of the people that make modern investment. He studied in Glasgow, and he is on the board of trustees at the University of Victoria Pension Fund, a member of the National Association of Business Economists, as am I, and the Conference of Business Economists and the Montreal and Victoria Societies of Financial Analysts. Welcome to the Farcast, Martin. You're wonderful to do this.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to join you.
Well, we're very glad you're here. Martin, we're looking at lots going on in the economy, and the markets are not behaving very nicely here, given what we've seen out of China. What are your thoughts about what's going on with this trade war and what it means, how likely it's going to get to be solved, and what it means for our economy and the rest of the world's economy?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of precedents for for trade wars. The one that springs to mind always is the 30s, and we know how that went. It didn't end that
yes.
well when you have a full-fledged protectionism around the world. So that would be the great fear, that it starts out as a squabble between the U.S. and China and degenerates into something worse. I think that's unlikely to happen. We're not going to have a repeat of the 30s. Trump is playing a bit of a dangerous game. He thinks he holds all the cards on this one and that China will buckle down, but China, I guess what we understand about Chinese psychology is they play a long game. They don't like they like to protect face. They don't like to give in to blackmail. So it's not at all clear how this is going to play out. It's bad news. I mean, I'm a free trade kind of guy, and I wish this wasn't happening. But on its own, I don't see it as something that's going to bring the global economy crashing down. It's just unfortunate. You know, we're in a slow growth world. We've got high debt levels. You've got demographic problems in a number of countries. So we don't really need this right now, to be honest. It's not happening at a great time. And all we can do is hope that there's a bit of bluffing going on, a bit of poker, and that they'll come to some sort of agreement in the next few weeks. But it's very hard.
So what do you think, Martin, of this notion that somehow Chinese bad behavior had to be addressed, and that they have been, sooner or later, shouldn't somebody
do something?
I kind of
agree with that. I agree with that. They haven't been playing totally. It hasn't been a fair game here between the U.S. and China. At the same time, I mean, the administration's view or the president's view that if you've got a trade deficit, it means you're somehow being screwed, if you pardon my language, makes no sense.
If you have a trade deficit,
if your economy is strong compared to everybody else and your demand is strong compared to everybody else, you're going to run a trade deficit. In fact, the administration's economic policies guarantee you're going to have a trade deficit, because if you cut taxes and run a very easy fiscal policy and try and stimulate private investment, it guarantees that you're going to have a trade deficit. But nonetheless, it was right to put some pressure on China, for sure.
Okay, so whenever I see consensus among investors, I also, that to me is risk. Whenever I see and what I'm seeing is consensus among investors now, and in fact, I've been saying it myself, is that this president needs a deal, and that at some point he will either come to a deal or fabricate a deal, but he'll put an end to these headlines somewhere prior to that 2020 election. I mean, it seems like it'll be common sense, but are we becoming too complacent that there will be a deal and that there will be a relief from these thumbscrews of negotiating out in public that the markets are having to endure?
I think it is complacent because there's a, if a, you know what the right analogy is, game of chicken, whatever, but you know there's a risk that either side could make a mistake here and misjudge what the other side is going to do. You know, the U.S. may be misjudging China's reaction, thinking that China will be forced to back down. Not necessarily the case if China takes a very long-term view here. So there is potential for a mistake. So, you know, President Trump has a pretty strong antipathy to the China trade deficit, so he might be prepared to push this way further than he should.
Well, today we heard the president, or I can't remember, might have been last night, said that everything would be made better if the Federal Reserve would simply cut rates now. The Federal Reserve, somehow, Martin, we were trading for the last few years on everything that the Fed said they were going to do with monetary policy, including a 20% pullback when the Fed would look like we were going to keep raising rates. Then they said they wouldn't, and we've seen this lovely market rally. But now the focus is on the tweets and the trade policy news. The president seems to be trying to get back to the Fed and put the blame there. What do you think? Give us your thoughts about another Fed rate cut, and where do you think we are generally in the U.S. in terms of monetary policy? Hot, cold, or just right?
I would say the monetary environment is still very accommodative. The economy is doing absolutely fine. The unemployment rate, as we all know, is below what most people would regard as a full employment level. The economy is running fairly hot here. In normal circumstances, you would think the Fed would be raising rates because it would be worried about inflation risks. Now, the one surprise about this whole current environment is that inflation has stayed much lower than you would have expected. So that's a key part of what the Fed is focused on, the inflation rate. So if there's no inflation on the horizon, they can afford to be patient here. But normal things that the Fed would look at, until this trade kerfuffle, the stock market has been strong. So you've had very strong asset prices. You've got a very low unemployment rate. You've got a lot of leverage in the corporate sector. All of those things would historically have been an environment where you'd expect rates need to go up, not down. So there's absolutely no reason for the Fed to be thinking about cutting rates at this point. You would need some big negative shock. And even on the trade thing, you would actually need to see signs that it's really, really hurting growth. And obviously it's way too soon to make that call.
Since you and I had lunch, I've talked.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm just thinking it's complete nonsense to talk about rate cuts at this point.
Since you and I had lunch with that very austere group of economists, I've talked to a couple of more Federal Reserve presidents, and a month or two ago, two or three were indicating that they thought they would stop selling the Fed's bond portfolio, the scheduled liquidation, sometime this summer. Do you think that that's prudent? I mean, that's still a form of easing if they stop the supply of that portfolio. That seemed to be what they say they were doing. I haven't heard much about it lately. Esther George came out today and said she didn't see any reason for a cut. Do you still expect them to do that? Have you been hearing that?
Well, I mean, the issue there, for the balance sheet. I mean, primarily, interest rates are still the main way the Fed runs its monetary policy. The sort of the whole balance sheet, the quantitative easing was kind of an extreme move in extreme circumstances. But interest rates are still the main way the Fed changes policy. They want to shrink that balance sheet over time, but they're under no real pressure. It's not causing them a problem. And the issue is they don't want to cause liquidity problems in the market if they shrink it too much. So I think, again, they can afford to be very, very patient here. People worried that quantitative easing, printing money, all the things people talked about was going to create inflation, and clearly it hasn't. So this big balance sheet that the Fed still has, they can live with that for quite a while. So I think they'll be careful about, running it down.
Well, and, when I think back to our luncheon of this group of strategists and economists that Martin hosted a couple of months ago, sort of one of the messages I heard was that one of the risks that people thought that they would see was a policy error by the Fed. It doesn't sound like you think they will make a policy error. Do you trust this Fed to stay on the sidelines?
Ultimately, they will make a policy error. Monetary policy is tough to get it right. And if you actually look back at the record of the Fed from a really big picture point of view, they were too tight in the 30s and certainly contributed to the Great Depression. They were too easy in the 60s and 70s and created the inflation that we had in the 70s. They were too relaxed about financial conditions and regulatory oversight during the housing bubble and set the scene for the greatest recession downturn since the 30s. So their record has not been great. So I have no confidence at all that they will avoid errors in the future. Now, hopefully they won't make errors as big as they did in the 30s and the 60s. But, to think that somehow that the Fed is able to raise rates just enough to slow the economy, that it can keep growing without inflation picking up. They've never been able to do it in the past. They never have. Monetary policy is a pretty blunt tool. So it's inevitable that at some point down the road, they're going to create another recession.
And do you see a recession soon? And where is the recession on the horizon?
Well, again, barring all the sort of trade nonsense that we're going through, no. Not at the moment, but I'm pretty confident we will get one. We haven't.
Well, that seems pretty safe.
I would think in the next 2 years.
Okay.
I thought we might have got one this year. I wrote a piece just after Trump took office, actually, and I said, beware the 2019 Trump recession. And it wasn't predicting that he would do anything bad. It was actually the opposite. I was saying if he follows through with his fiscal policy, cutting taxes, increasing spending when the economy is already hot, he is going to create an inflation problem that will force the Fed to tighten and create a recession. That was what I thought would happen. I wrote that in early 2017, but that hasn't happened because inflation has stayed surprisingly calm. But down the road, that is still the risk.
It looked like you were going to be right coming into December. It looked like you were going to be right. So I have this theory, Martin, and go ahead and tell me why it's stupid. I'm going to confess that it is somewhat Kudlow-esque in its optimism, but I am hopeful.
You upset me already.
it didn't take me long, did it? I am seeing, the wage gains as actual as rather positive signs that if they could continue, because we have not had any supply side problems with this forced recovery. What we've had is a demand problem. It's been a great dearth of demand. We can produce more donuts. We just can't produce more eaters and buyers of donuts. So perhaps with these wage gains, we will be able to get more cash into the hands of the middle class and the average American consumer, and we could begin to see an actual organic economic recovery and expansion if the Fed will allow it to heat up a bit and stay on the sidelines a bit. That's my theory. That's my hope. We're beginning to see it. Do you think it's just ridiculously optimistic, and have I fallen prey to the Kudlow
creed? I wouldn't say it's ridiculously optimistic, but look, so what you need to do is expand the supply side of the economy, not the demand side. You know, if you just raise demand, if you just put more money in people's hands through faster wage growth and they go out and buy your donuts, if you're not going to increase the supply of donuts, you're going to create inflation and you'll overheat and the Fed will be forced to raise rates. So what's really needed is to improve the supply side of the economy, which means more investment from the corporate sector, productive investment, not investment in housing, but actually investment in industrial capacity, and increased productivity. Now we're seeing some hints that productivity growth is picking up, but it's it's a volatile series. It hasn't been going on long enough to know if this is just another head fake. But the issue is not increasing demand. We have dumped a lot of money into the economy here. Demand is not that bad. It's the supply side that we need to improve. The potential growth rate of the economy is going to be dictated by productivity.
Be by productivity, but just if you'll permit me to be argumentative for another moment, and he's, you know, Harry, he's never going to do this show again. Perhaps that demand pull, Martin, in this kind of a tight employment sort of an environment, would then force the investment into that productivity area. And the capex that we're looking for. I'm just trying to figure out a way to make all of that happen.
Perhaps. Look, the environment for capital spending in recent years has been pretty favorable. You've had record profits, record margins, a low unemployment rate, very, very low interest rates, so the cost of borrowing is very, very low. And then capital spending has not been that strong. So companies' willingness to spend depends on a lot of things. It's their confidence in the future, I suppose. And when you've got this kind of trade battles going on, you've got a lot of political divisiveness and political uncertainty. I can see why companies are reluctant to embark on major capital spending projects. There's, to the extent that they're borrowing, it's much more for financial engineering, for share buybacks and M&A activity. So you could hardly have asked for a more favorable backdrop to capital spending than you've already had.
A little bit of wait and see. We're right up at the end of our time, Martin. I can't thank you enough. Any final advice for investors as they think about the balance of 2019?
Well, again, the trade issue is the current focus of the markets, and it's hard to know exactly how that's going to play out. But abstracting beyond that, as long as the Fed is on hold here, then it's a pretty favorable environment for risk assets. So once we get through this trade uncertainty, I would expect the market to do fine. And the real problems are going to occur if we do get an inflation pickup that's got the Fed tightening again. And I would not be surprised to see that towards the end of this year or into next year.
Martin, so I can't thank you enough.
We're okay for the moment.
Okay for the moment. Final words from my wonderful friend and great guest, Martin Barnes, chief economist at BCA Research, one of the smartest guys I ever get to talk to ever. And
oh,
I'm
gosh,
so
you need to talk to more people.
I talk to lots of people. You're one of the smartest. Can't thank you enough. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it again this week for us on the Farcast. We'll be back with you again next Tuesday. Thank you so much for taking us along in your cars and to the gym with us, in your earbuds, in your homes, in your offices. It is a great honor, privilege, and pleasure. I am as grateful as I can be. From Naples, Florida this week, I'll be in Washington next week. Thank you so much. I'm Michael Farr.
Thank you for listening to this week's Farrcast. Please subscribe and share with a friend. Farrcast comes to you each week on all major podcasting platforms. We hope you enjoy the show as much as we enjoy making it for you. Farrcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings, and our production engineer is Claude Jennings. We are coming to you tonight from our virtual studio on the internet, but our home studio is Chatter Studio in Friendship Heights, Washington, D.C. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at farrcast@farrmiller.com. Let us know what you liked, what you think we got wrong, and what topics you'd like to hear in coming weeks. We would like to remind you that if you think you've heard a recommendation to buy or sell any security here on the Farrcast, you haven't. Farrcast podcast is for informational purposes only, and it should not be considered legal or financial advice. Before you make any investment decision, we strongly recommend you consult with a financial professional to determine what may be best for your individual needs and your goals. And if we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington, please reach out to us at invest@farrmiller.com. Our team of professionals does more than just pick stocks and trade bonds. We work with our clients to reach their goals. We have a great lineup of guests upcoming on the Farrcast. In coming weeks, we have scheduled Jane Pethakoukas of the American Enterprise Institute, Jim Urio from the Chicago Merck, and audience favorite Jack Barugian of UCX. Go beyond the headlines every week with the Farrcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world.